Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Delaware River Basin Commission has a new executive director. Kristen Bauman Cavanaugh will meet her this morning and find out about some of her immediate priorities and how the DRBC maintains a balance between answering to multiple bosses, including four state governors and several federal agencies. We'll get a closer look at Governor Kathy Hochul's affordable child care proposals ahead of her State of the State address tomorrow. And are you feeling mentally ready for 2025? We'll chat with the commissioner of the Ulster County Department of Mental Health about some easy strategies that can make a meaningful difference in how you feel and function in the new year. Plus, James B. Huntington, local economist and author with a local look at the economy. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. In Los Angeles, stronger winds are in the forecast for the next 72 hours. That could complicate efforts by fire crews to contain the major fires that continue to burn in and around the city. Steve Futterman reports 24 people have been killed.
It is the one thing people here do not want. The increased winds will continue for the next 3 days. The strongest are forecast to come late Tuesday into Wednesday. Because of the threat, fire crews are being pre-positioned in areas thought to be vulnerable. Ryan Chadwick is in the Mandeville Canyon area.
Fire's obviously continuing to go, but we're keeping it contained, keeping it away from the houses. From here, right now, things are looking good around these homes.
As strong as these winds will be, they are not expected to be nearly equal to the tremendously strong winds last week. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
California Governor Gavin Newsom says he has already ordered work to begin on fire recovery. More than 12,000 structures have been damaged or lost in the L.A. blazes. Investigators are evaluating the structure before debris removal begins. The governor says he estimates it will take between 6 and 9 months to remove all the fire wreckage. Negotiations continue in Qatar to try to reach a ceasefire deal in Gaza. Representatives from Israel, Hamas, and the U.S. are in close proximity in Qatar reviewing proposals. The outgoing Biden administration and members of the incoming Trump administration are working together on the issues. NPR's Daniel Estrin says they both want some kind of agreement reached before Biden leaves office.
I spoke with an official with knowledge of the ongoing talks who's not authorized to speak publicly, but who said Trump's team has told Israel that by the inauguration, they want either a deal or a declaration of principles, which would be some kind of document that would, you know, lock the sides into a commitment toward a deal.
And Pierre's Daniel Estrin reporting. Stocks open mixed this morning as oil prices jump. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 140 points in early trading.
Oil prices jumped sharply over the weekend after the Biden administration added new sanctions against Russia's energy sector. The benchmark for U.S. crude topped $78 a barrel. So far, the higher crude prices have not filtered down to the gas pump. AAA says regular gas is selling for an average of just over $3.06 a gallon, little change from a week ago. U.S. Steel has gotten a little more time to cancel its planned sale to Japan's Nippon Steel. President Biden moved to block that sale, citing national security concerns, but an interagency committee agreed to delay the effective date of that order until mid-June. Stock in U.S. Steel rose on the news. The company still hoped to salvage the deal. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 142 points. The Nasdaq is down 230. This is NPR. The U.S. Geological Survey says an earthquake hit southeastern Japan today with a magnitude of 6.9. Japanese authorities issued a tsunami advisory, but there are no immediate reports of damage. Japanese officials say they're going to investigate to see if this tremor could be linked to its warning last year for the potential of a megaquake. Canada's foreign affairs minister says she is considering all options when it comes to countermeasures against tariffs threatened by President-elect Trump. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, that's the message Canadian leaders will take to Washington next week.
During an interview with CTV News, Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly was asked if she would cut off energy exports to the U.S. in response to tariffs. Joly said, quote, Everything is on the table, adding it's a conversation she would have with Republican decision-makers. Canada's leaders say Trump's threat of a 25% tariff on Canadian products would be devastating for the economies of both countries. Some premiers are against cutting off energy exports to retaliate. The premiers are to meet with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau this week to formulate a Canadian response to the tariffs. Jolie says she's calling on every political leader in Canada to be on board because this is no time for division. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The world's largest religious gathering has begun in Prayagraj, India. Over the next 6 weeks, nearly 400 million Hindus will join the Maha Kumbh Festival. Many will conduct ritual bathing in the confluence of three rivers, including the Ganges. This Hindu festival is held once about every 12 years. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. After 5 years as deputy director, Kristen Bowman Kavanaugh stepped into her new role as executive director of the Delaware River Basin Commission on December 1st. Kavanaugh describes the DRBC as the hub of a wheel, with Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and the federal government forming its spokes. Joining us now is the new executive director of the DRBC, Kristen Bowman Kavanaugh. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And I try to describe what the DRBC sort of is in the middle of these four states in the federal government. And many people are unfamiliar with DRBC and its role. So how would you explain it to someone who doesn't really know about the commission's work, especially regarding this unique structure?
Well, I think a couple of things are important to understand, even before I try to explain that, because I have to admit that five years ago, I don't know that I had the correct picture of what the DRBC really is. So the DRBC was formed in 1961, and we're a federal interstate commission. And what that means is we're not federal government and we're not state government. We're a commission that was formed when those four basin states and the federal government all enacted legislation at the same time through the Delaware River Basin Compact to create this agency that has certain authority through which they can work through. And as you also know, the Delaware River is an interstate river. It's a boundary between the four states along its entire length, and that creates some, you know, interesting relationships among the states. And so my hub and spoke kind of analogy is a way to sort of explain that, unlike the EPA, for example, which is completely separate from the states and can enact a regulation and say, here, go comply with this. You know, the DRBC, we are not a separate entity from the states because they are our commissioners. So the work that we do is all driven by our commissioners and their approvals. So what we are is really, I kind of think of it as a little bit of a department that is formed by each of the states and the federal governments. And we're a legal mechanism for the states and federal government to come together when they choose to collaboratively and collectively manage water resources in the basin. Hopefully that helps explain the hub and spoke analogy a little bit better.
Yeah, you kind of are a mediator, as you've described the DRBC in some ways, between the states and the federal government. Can you dive a little deeper into how this role plays out in the day-to-day operations of the commission?
Yeah, I mean, it plays out in different ways. Certainly on a day-to-day basis, our technical staff have a lot of direct coordination with technical staff from the four states and the federal government. And this can be on permitting and regulatory matters in terms of not wanting to duplicate effort, but to make sure that when we have related permits or dockets, that they're filling in the gaps and consistent and not creating regulatory nightmares for permit holders. And also connecting and coordinating, facilitating things like monitoring activities or studies on the river. And then certainly at a higher level, when it comes to our commissioners, we provide a role in convening the five signatory members to come together to talk about, you know, large issues, you know, big issues related to regulations or approaches to move forward and, you know, what are hot topic items in the future that they may want to collaborate on in the future. One specific example in particular I can think of in terms of using your term, you know, mediating between the states and federal government would be related to a rule that the EPA proposed to upgrade the aquatic life designated use and associated DO criteria in the urban portion of the estuary. And EPA is proposing to finalize that regulation. And in the meantime, DRBC has continued to provide technical support to the EPA and the federal government to support that regulation, because a lot of that work was based on technical work and modeling and monitoring studies that DRBC had been doing since the mid-teens. And then also we've been coordinating, convening regularly with our state members to help provide technical support in thinking about how that rule will be implemented at the state level. So that's one specific example of how we sort of work between and among the states and the federal government to advance water resource management.
What are some of the immediate priorities you've set for yourself as the new executive director of DRBC?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, the Delaware River Basin Compact really guides, it's our North Star in terms of guiding our mission and the work that we do. And strategically, I see three kind of main things that I need to focus on to make sure that I can advance that mission. First off is making sure that we advance sound science and regulations so that we can have informed water resource management. And that's something fundamental that the commission does. It's a large part of why we were created, if you look in the compact. And that's just one of the core things that we do. In order to do that well, we also need to leverage communication and partnerships so we can extend our reach and increase our impact, because we are a pretty small organization. And then we have to make sure that we're being responsible in terms of how we organize our agency and how we manage it. Immediately, three top priorities I have are I already mentioned one of them, which is continuing to lead coordination and provide technical support to our states in developing that implementation plan for the DO regulations once they're issued by the EPA. Another top priority is in the realm of climate resilience planning. This is an area where the DRBC has done a lot of work for the last 10 to 15 years on the technical side in particular. And last June, our commissioners approved a resolution directing our staff to actually develop a climate resilience plan. And that is taking a little bit of a step back in looking organizational-wide, not just at our specific technical programs, to come up with a plan in a coordinated way so we can better communicate that to the public and to our members in terms of what we are doing, defining a clear vision for our role in climate resilience and identifying and prioritizing actions in a more systematic way. And then the third priority I see immediate and ongoing is to secure sustainable funding. Like most organizations, you know, funding is always a top priority to make sure we have the resources necessary to do our mission.
I pulled up the compact here, and as you mentioned, it was drafted in 1961. There is a section here in part one that talks about the demands upon the waters and related resources of the basins expected to mount rapidly because of the increase in population. And it specifically mentions the population projections reaching 40 million by 2010 and anticipated increase in industrial growth projected to double by 1980. So in 2025, it feels like maybe, is it a little outdated? And how is the DRBC preparing for these challenges since this draft and also with climate change increasingly impacting the region in all of those areas?
Yeah, and it's interesting the historical snapshot you get, right, of what was going on in 1961. Certainly the basin population is not 40 million. It's about a little less than a tenth of that right now. And water use has gone up significantly since 1961, but there's also been a lot of efforts in conservation and efficiency. So if you look at some of the projections from them and even some of the interim projections, it hasn't gone up quite as much. But managing the resource is still an ongoing challenge. There are certainly challenges we face now that weren't necessarily anticipated in 1960. You mentioned climate change. And the way that we are thinking about preparing for that with respect to changing precipitation patterns and rising sea levels and water scarcity is in a couple of different ways. You know, I mentioned we have a lot of technical work we've done over the years, doing studies on how does sea level rise impact flow management on the main stem, how might climate change impact hydrology, i.e. the water cycle in the future, and what does that look like in terms of water availability? And then also looking at the effects of climate change on water quality in the estuary and DO concentrations. Also looking at freshwater storage. So there's quite a portfolio of technical work that we do. And then the climate resilience plan that we've embarked on this past year is our commitment to defining a clear vision for our role and being able to communicate better with the public and seek impact as well in terms of how we approach that and where our role is, where we can best fill the gaps in terms of looking at what our state members are doing, federal government, what's already happening, and where we can best add value.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Kristen Bowman Kavanaugh, the new executive director of the Delaware River Basin Commission, who just started that role December 1st. But prior to that, 5 years as deputy director of the DRBC. Can you share a little bit about your journey and what made this opportunity as executive director the right fit for you?
Yeah, thank you. I am technically from Philadelphia. I was born here, but I actually did not grow up in Philadelphia. My family moved out west when I was a baby, and I spent half of my life there, including starting my career as a civil and environmental engineer out there. What I will say about my time out west is that it's a very arid environment. It's very different than the East Coast in terms of hydrology and the water cycle. And what that did, because I think about a third of the time I lived there, the state was in some kind of drought condition, and it really instilled in me a profound sense of the value of water and its importance to life and the environment, you know, economic development, you name it. So even though where I live now, we have a lot more water than the West Coast, it's still a valuable and precious commodity, and that really inspired me to get involved in the field of water. I spent most of my 30-year career as a consulting engineer, and what that meant was working with a lot of water and wastewater utilities throughout the United States on individual projects, helping them understand the impacts of their discharges and on water quality and how that could impact the environment, how they can best comply with regulations. So I was actually sort of on the other side of the fence in terms of helping people comply with regulations. Now I work for a regulator, and what really brought me here was the desire to want to impact and have a way to improve water resources on a broader scale. So instead of helping one facility at a time advance good management, it was really exciting to think about working for an agency that's taking it on a much more holistic scale, but still very much involved in the science and engineering side of things.
Having lived and worked out west, I believe in California, I just want to get your reaction to what you're seeing with the Los Angeles fires, specifically related to the fact that there's a long, as you mentioned, always in, the state was always in some state of drought, and the area in Los Angeles and Los Angeles County was in a state of drought. What's your reaction to seeing what's going on there now?
Well, it's really devastating. My family, thankfully, does not live anywhere near where the fires are, so my family is safe. But I actually have close friends and colleagues who lost their homes. There's nothing left. I have other former colleagues and friends who have been evacuated for upwards of a week now. And it's, you know, it's hard to imagine if you're not living the experience yourself. And growing up, we did have fires. And the last time there was a really big fire that I remember was in 2003 when I was visiting family. And it's really hard to imagine. If you're not close to it, you can't see it, but you're still aware of its presence. You know, soot falls on the cars throughout the LA basin, air quality is impacted. And, you know, from a water resource perspective, there certainly seems to be an increased frequency of these fires that are happening right now. You know, I'm not a wildfire expert. I think that I've read some articles about the lack of water to fight the fires and, you know, perhaps the need to rethink the planning that they do in terms of water supply planning when it comes to fire suppression and water available to do that. So really, really tragic situation. And I certainly hope for the best for all of those who are being impacted.
And of course, we had to deal with drought conditions, and I believe we're still dealing with some drought conditions here in the Northeast. And DRBC, you know, it intersects with your work there, especially with regard to water withdrawals during the drought conditions. Can you explain a little bit about that and how, you know, that impacts your work?
Certainly can. First off, I'll say that we're really excited, really thankful that it finally started raining.
Yeah.
At the end of November. As everyone knows, throughout the basin from top to bottom, we had a very dry fall. And in early December, the DRBC declared a water supply emergency as a first step towards getting prepared to address that. And the DRBC does have several regulations and programs in place to deal with low flow and drought conditions. For our very large consumptive use withdrawers in the basin, we have requirements for developing drought management conservation plans. For our hydroelectric facilities, we have a consumptive use replacement policy, which requires them, if we get into a critical condition, to have a plan to be able to replace water so they can continue to operate and generate electricity in the basin. We also have both basin-wide and a lower basin drought management plan. And we certainly think about water availability in our docket review. Those are our permit reviews, whether it's a surface water or groundwater discharge, in terms of looking at the available data to make sure that there's enough water to allocate on that basis.
There's been ongoing discussion about the potential for changes to the fracking ban in the basin. How do you view these prospects and what impact they might have on the DRBC mission?
Well, I'd rather not speculate at this point, but what I can say is that we are definitely tracking policy developments in that area. And if and when we have reasonable certainty, we'll be planning for those. And otherwise, we're going to remain focused on the Commission's forward-looking priorities. I certainly recognize that the regulations that the Commission implemented were a long time coming and certainly represented a big step for many, regardless of how you felt them, whether you were pro or against. It was a an important step that the Commission took, and we will wait to see what develops.
How do you see the DRBC's role evolving with the new federal administration in Washington, D.C.? More mediation?
Yeah, certainly in 7 days is Inauguration Day. That's a big day for our country. And in our basin, the Commission has historically received bipartisan support, and we work with all of the members of our federal and state delegations. My personal experience is that people of all political affiliations care a lot about water. They care a lot about the water they drink. They care a lot about the water that they recreate in and that supports their local economies. So we will continue to communicate with and work with the new administration to identify shared priorities around our water resources. And I think there always are shared priorities, even if we don't agree on everything.
Well, Kirsten, it's great to meet you and talk to you. So much more we can talk about. We welcome you back at any time to talk about more of the work that you're doing at DRBC, especially all of the different programs and conditions that you're working on in terms of climate resiliency and also protecting the water and the watershed. Again, we've been speaking with Executive Director of the Delaware River Basin Commission, Kirsten Bowman Kavanaugh. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you next time I'm in the Upper Basin.
Come on over.
Great.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, are you ready for 2025 mentally? We'll get some tips from the Ulster County Commissioner of Mental Health. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, it's January 13th, but are you still feeling mentally ready for 2025? Whatever your answer, there are some tried and true habits to help you feel sharp and alive and continue to do well in the coming year, and they're easy to practice. Joining us now is Tara McDonald, the Commissioner of the Ulster County Department of Mental Health. Good morning.
Good morning and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Well, I don't know about you, but maybe I'm not feeling mentally ready for 2025, even though it's already started. So there, what are some things that we can kind of practically put into practice here to, you know, help us feel our best? I think that one of the first things that most people talk about is just any kind of physical activity, right?
Absolutely. Physical health and mental health work together. So when you are engaging in physical activity, all of the endorphins and the blood flow, and you're just going to feel so much better after it. So I definitely encourage that. And at any level, right, it could be walking. It could be those seated roller things that you use for just your legs. It could be strength training. As we get older, strength training is really important. Anything that you can do to move your body.
So let's talk about anxiety, which I guess I was alluding to at the beginning there. Many surveys show Americans are anxious. What are some ways that folks can manage that tendency to worry?
So I think that it's multifactored. And one of the things is really trying to be mindful about any shifts in your mental health, right? And anxiety, you're right. There's an increased amount of anxiety that we're all struggling with. So I always suggest to folks that before there's a shift in a mental health issue or you're struggling with something in terms of your mental health, you get your toolbox together, right? What are those tools that speak to you that have the ability to sort of bring you back to a homeostatic state within your emotional and psychological well-being? Those tools can be, again, could be physical, could be exercising. It could be just being in nature. It could be reading or puzzles or possibly connecting with friends and family. And have those tools ready before so that once you start to feel a shift, see a shift, you can just grab at what that toolbox is, out of that toolbox, so that you're prepared and, again, mindful. It is the rare person that never finds themselves struggling with some mental health challenge on some degree or another. So this is advice for all of us.
And part of that is confronting your fears, right? What you're directly sort of anxious about to help break that pattern.
Absolutely. And confronting it in a way in which that you're taking it on so that it doesn't, like, I wouldn't do it all at once, right? If it's financial troubles, relational troubles, I would try and take it in smaller chunks and so that it can feel as if it's doable. It can feel not overwhelming. And I think that at the very least, what we need to be able to do is to give ourselves grace. You know, life is hard. Things come at us quickly and fast, and it depends on, you know, your level of responsibility and it's just important that we take care of ourselves. Yeah.
And another thing to try to do is to try not to catastrophize. I have been paying specific attention to these fires in Los Angeles. I woke up this morning, looked out my window, and across the field saw a fire. And I immediately thought I needed to call 911. Somebody's just burning something there and the mountain wasn't on fire. So, you know, you have to, what can you do to kind of, you know, not catastrophize and devote a lot of energy to a problem?
That's a hard one, right? Because it depends on how much level of anxiety you're having based on whatever it is that you're catastrophizing about. But again, I think if you're intentional and you're saying to yourself, I tend to do this, I'm going to try and work on not doing that this year, recognizing that you may be one that catastrophizes things and then bringing yourself down. It's really about being mindful in the moment. I suggest also that limiting the amount of time that we spend, scrolling through our social media, watching the news, it makes it hard when all you're hearing and seeing is bad stuff, not to catastrophize the little things. So it's another multi-factor. You're going to limit what, those things that you can limit that are really disturbing. And then you're going to be mindful in the moment to say, that's something that I tend to do. I'm going to try not to do it. And maybe, again, little chunks. So maybe you'll give yourself 2 minutes of catastrophizing where it may have been 20. It's not for the fact that you are, really mindful that you're trying to be able to decrease that. And again, giving ourselves the grace to know that I may do it well today. Tomorrow may be a struggle and I'm back trying it again on Wednesday because it just feels so bad, right? It's a negative feeling.
Well, I did do that. Now that you mentioned it, I did not call 911 and allowed myself to think about what was happening and then kind of process it. Also have a cup of coffee and wake up.
Exactly.
I also challenging your brain. That's a good way to help kind of stay mentally fit. Are there specific activities or things you can recommend for strengthening cognitive abilities, like puzzles or new learning skills or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. As I mentioned before, and it really is what speaks to you. I had so much reading to do in terms of my career that I don't find myself being a reader outside of those times, right? But if you are a reader and you like to be able to be immersed in somebody else's story, that's a great way. I am a great crossword puzzle person, so I can do that for hours, and just not thinking about anything else just feels so rejuvenating. So it really is whatever speaks to you.
Get a good night's sleep. Always good advice.
People, I don't know if people realize how much sleep plays a role in your ability to be able to think and also with your mental health. We all have different times or different, it depending on how old you are, developmentally, how much sleep you'll need. But I would take a look at that. I'd speak to your doctor and say, at my age, what is the perfect amount of sleep that I should be getting and strive to do it.
And one of those things you kind of alluded to earlier was scrolling through social media and stuff with these modern distractions like that. That can prevent you from getting enough good quality sleep because you're spending more time just doing that, even sometimes before you go to bed.
Absolutely. They say that you should, cut off internet and social media for like an hour before going to sleep. I sleep with my TV on, and I know that that's not great. So I'm going to try and be intentional this year and turn it off because thoughts kind of, I'm hearing what's going on in the TV and it's, going through my brain while I'm trying to be resting. So I know that that's a goal for me this year. But whatever it is that you find that allows for you to really get into that restful state so that your brain can rejuvenate for the next day.
We're talking to Tara McDonald, the commissioner of the Ulster County Department of Mental Health, about feeling mentally ready for the new year. In the new year, there's always some new phrases. A couple of phrases I've heard called friction audit or future casting. What are these kind of concepts? I guess they're to help you kind of get unstuck if you're feeling stuck.
Yeah, it is a sign of really good mental health when you are future oriented. Today could be hard, but I know that tomorrow I have the ability to change it. So if you're thinking, if you're stuck in the moment, feeling as if whatever it is, the struggles that you're going through today is just going to continue to perpetuate, then you're not really going to be able to find your way through it. If you're taking a more future-oriented sort of approach, then I can move through this. It may take time. It may not be pretty as I'm moving through it, but I can do it. And you continue in that future orientation.
Yeah, we're going to be only a high of 23 tomorrow, and it's been kind of cold lately. But heat, it relates to your mental performance. How does that impact your mental performance?
I mean, I think being as comfortable, and again, because this is so variable, I'm a woman of a certain age, and heat is not necessarily my friend. I have my own personal summer, so it depends on what you find to be comfortable for you, and just managing your environment, basically.
Yeah, another thing is just trying to quiet that inner critic. We all have that inner critic that says, I can't believe I did this, or I'm so stupid. Trying to distance yourself from thoughts like that.
Right. And they seep in, right? Yeah. They seep in. And sometimes they have the ability to say, to sort of help to push you forward, right? But with everything, it's a matter of, this is that moment. I need to move through this. Okay, I may not have been my best in that moment, but I have lots of moments previous that I've done really well, and in the future, I will do even better. So, yes, it's important to quiet your inner critic. Just know that it's not always that easy to do.
Yeah. Give yourself a little grace there. Also, take care of your physical health. We know, you should know that your brain and your body are connected. Another way to kind of become more mentally fit is available to others is to be with others, make a new friend. That's another way to help with your mental health, because feeling lonely or isolated can hurt or harm you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. COVID really did a job on us as a society. I think that there are still folks that are dealing and struggling with the sense of isolation. Lots of things didn't come back after we were able to move through that COVID, the shutdown piece of COVID. So I think that we can all do a little bit better in terms of getting connected, remaining connected. We may not have all a huge social circle of 700 people. That may not be it. Maybe that we're all not comfortable with that. But find that person that you feel as if, if you're having a bad day or even wanting to share something great that's going on, not everything is all bad. Setting an intention for this year to be able to continue to find and maintain connection.
Yeah, there's still so much impact that we're all feeling, whether we realize it or not, from that time. And we're still cycling out of that in a way. And so it's, again, give yourself some grace there and understand what that is. But, maybe try to reconnect if you feel like it. And then one other tip here, forgive or forgiveness is good for us, but you don't always have to make that the thing that you do, whether it's good for you or not, I guess, right?
Right, right. It's certainly, they say that forgiveness is really for you as opposed to the person that you're forgiving. I think it depends on what it is that you're trying to forgive, but I think that it's something that we should strive to do, right, is to forgive. It's important that we try to make sure that we're not looking for perfection, we're looking for progress. So if it is two people I was able to forgive versus, the 20 that are on my list, then that's progress.
Yeah. Tara McDonald, I just wanted to thank you again for joining us. You run the Ulster County, the Commissioner for the Ulster County Department of Mental Health, dealing with the mental health challenges, substance abuse and other services. But within that department, there is the Ulster County Center for Well-Being. So thank you for taking time to focus on that part of mental health with us today. And anything else you want folks to know about the department?
Just that we have some really great things that are going to be happening in terms of resources in the county this year. As you guys know, we got back at least half of our mental health beds. So we're inpatient mental health beds at Health Alliance, and we're hoping to be able to continue to divert people from needing to go to the hospital with the launching of the Ulster County Crisis Support Center this year, hopefully by March, and that will be located in the same building as the department is at 368 Broadway on the first floor. So the build-out is continuing. We're going to be getting furniture soon, and we're going to try and help some people to be able to move through crises in their own lives.
There's, in addition to your website, ulstercountyny.gov/mental-health, there's also other resources at wellnessrecovery.org. That's a public service maintained by the Mental Health Association in Ulster County, right?
That is correct. Yes, that is correct.
So a lot of resources there. Tara McDonald is the commissioner for the Ulster County Department of Mental Health. Well, I'm feeling a little bit more mentally prepared for 2025. Thank you.
That's great. That's great.
All right. Take care. We'll have you back again soon. Take care.
Thanks, Tim. Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll take a break. And when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatsko.
Say, if you're tired of the cold outside, join us inside for the annual Retro Cocktail Hour All Exotica Show. where we'll sweep you away to a tropical climate with tunes by the new Les Baxter Orchestra, the Waikiki Seven, the Islanders, and more. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul will deliver her third State of the State address tomorrow, laying out her vision for the year ahead. Join Radio Catskill for live special coverage from the New York Public News Network starting at 1, hosted by Dave Lombardo with analysis from Ian Pickus and Chantel Smith before and after the address. It's the 2025 State of the State address tomorrow afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Monday, we check in with our local economist and author, James B. Huntington, for some local economic perspective. James B. joining us now. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make it. Well, let's check out that jobs report that came out on Friday. What did that tell us about the state of the economy?
Well, the headline news was the 256,000 net new non-farm payroll positions when the estimates were about 165 or 170. That's very good. We don't need the estimates even to tell us that was a great result on that. Seasonally adjusted and unadjusted unemployment were off, which were... Yes, from unemployment I'm talking about was 0.1% and 0.2%. They're now 4.1 and 3.8. Number of unemployed dropped 200,000 to 6.9 million, with 100,000 of them fewer who were out for 27 weeks or longer compared with the previous month. The count of people working part-time for economic reasons or those who are looking for full-time work but hanging on only to part-time work, they dropped 100,000 also to 4.4 million. The two measures showing how common it is for Americans to really actually be working or officially jobless, those are the employment population ratio and the labor force participation rate. The former one was up 0.2% to 60% even, and the labor force participation rate stayed the same at 62.5. We lost 162,000 of unadjusted unemployed, and earnings, average private non-farm hourly payroll wages reached $35.76, up 8 cents, a hair less than inflation. The American Job Shortage Number, or AJSN, showing latent demand for jobs went up 300,000 on some statistical changes. It's now at 16.2 million. Overall, it was a good report. It was certainly a thumbs up proposition, but we lost almost 700,000 net in the labor force. So, a lot of people who may have looked got back into the workforce in the previous few months, found they couldn't get anything, got out. So that's something to keep an eye on. If you took people out of the workforce who don't think they can find jobs and unemployment gets lower because it's based on a percentage, then that is really not all that much of an improvement. So this was good, but not great, and does have a cause for concern there for 2025.
Well, even though it was a better than expected jobs report, also what wasn't really great was that stocks plunged on Friday. Why was that?
Well, that is because they decided that the number of jobs means that there may not be as many interest rate cuts next year. So that discouraged them there. It is kind of backwards. It was good news, but it's not looking as good for many more interest rates. I mean, I could even see if it comes to this. I mean, they'll never know until right before they make the decision. But I could easily see this year being flat or maybe down a quarter point for the entire year because it's going well. Inflation could lose a little, but the jobs situation continues to be strong, and I don't think they want to risk overheating that.
Well, let's talk about some of the news from this morning. All morning long, we've been hearing about this surplus in China. Their trade surplus reached a record of nearly $1 trillion. What does that mean? Walk us through it.
Well, it doesn't mean a great deal, really. What happened was their December exports were up 10.7% when there were projections that they would go up 7%. The reason is they're preparing for Trump getting into office and putting through higher tariffs. So a lot of businesses have been hustling in China over the last couple of months to get their product over here now when the tariffs don't apply. That will probably continue because it's not going to be instantaneous even if the tariffs happen. So there's going to be we don't really know what's going to happen with Trump's thing in general. I think I've said this before. I mean, he promised a great deal on the campaign, and even if he's totally sincere about wanting to do those things, some of them are going to hit political reality. It's the Congress, especially the House, with a Republican majority of one, is not just going to give him everything he wants. And he may be finding out things, reactions and such from other countries and getting advice on these anyway. So we don't know what will actually happen. It certainly seems like there are going to be a bunch of new tariffs, and China's at the front of the line for countries to be affected by those. So expect, yeah, China will have strong exports, a lot of which are going to this country, but it's not really anything profound that happened here.
Let's shift a little bit and talk about some financial weaknesses that older Americans have. A surprising number of older Americans have. What are these financial weaknesses?
Yes, this was discouraging to see this. This was actually the Bergen Record in New Jersey from USA Today. So it revealed that a large share of retirees have credit card debt. Now, I think of credit card debt as something that happens when you're starting a career and your salary isn't making up for everything and you're borrowing for the future because the future certainly looks like you're going to be paid a lot more. But retirement is really a steady or maybe even declining state here. So we have, among people 75 and older, 53% are carrying credit card debt. 68% of retirees in general have credit card debt. That's an awful lot. Yeah. That's a bad thing really to do if you're not expecting a lot more money, and it's almost always a bad thing to do when paying for consumables, food and travel and trips and such things, and that people are doing that they should not be borrowing money, running credit cards for that. If you need to get a car or something and you think that the price, you'll have trouble handling it otherwise, large household appliances, that sort of thing. It isn't so bad if you really don't have a choice, but it is a very expensive way to get money. I mean, it can cost you 20% easily per year, and that's a whale of a lot. Remember, we've been talking about 3% and 4% interest rates, and this is 20. So yeah, Watch out. If you see yourself here, you may be have some real rewards by paying this off and tightening the belt for a while, because it's not a good trend at all.
There are some everyday behaviors by flight passengers that could be red flags for the TSA agents at airports, including excessive yawning that could get you held up at the airport. Talk to us a little bit about some of these red flags.
Believe it or not, yeah, this is Fox News coming up with a good piece of insight into things we don't know. I mean, we see the TSA people and they know they're often looking at something, but things that bother them especially are, yes, they mentioned the yawning. A lot of people who are seen to be yawning a lot. If they're dressed for weather that doesn't match either location, either the departure place or the arrival place, that's something that could be a cause for concern. Also, unusual lack of eye contact, people constantly looking way in the distance, and an excessive amount of talking or conversing with TSA agents and such that may be probably is benign, but it may be trying to distract them from doing their jobs. So overall, they're looking for groups of these things. They're looking for more than one. If you yawn a great deal, you may have just been up all night or something. But if you do that and won't look at anyone and you're dressed in a winter coat going from Phoenix to Orlando or something, they may notice that. So be careful about this. It is kind of a nuisance. I personally got some unusual TSA attention when I was wrapping a decrepit pair of shoes in duct tape, and I think they wondered what I was doing. It turned out there was nothing. It didn't really affect me, but I had people asking me questions for 15 minutes, you know, what is in those shoes sort of thing. So it can happen when you're completely innocent that you stumble into these. So be aware.
It does sound a little questionable, James B. I'm kidding. Yeah. Let's talk about the numbers. What were the stock oil prices, metal and prices this morning, and how'd they change?
Okay, over the past week, these were prices early this morning. Gold, $26.77. That's up 41. It's one of the better outcomes we had, as you will see, for anything. It's interesting. I don't know why it's doing that. Maybe a little more instability, or there is so much money out there that gold just getting a little more popular as an investment could cause it to go up 41 or more. Silver, $29.96. That's just over an 89-to-1 ratio, which is really creeping up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 41,938, dropped 794, with, as you said, 700 of that being on Friday. It was almost a break-even week before that. NASDAQ, 19,162 minus 460. It did worse percentage-wise. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 77.71. Ooh, that's up a hair short of $4, which means it's up over $7 over the past 2 weeks. It's surprising. We're going to see some things at the pump pretty soon. We've avoided them as far as I can tell thus far, but expect some of them to get higher within the week. Bitcoin, 92,947, down 61.85. The Bitcoin gains giveth and the Bitcoin gains taketh away. Last week was plus 5,400. It's oscillating around. I think it really doesn't know exactly what's going to happen with the upcoming administration and other things. Trump is supposed to like Bitcoin a great deal, but we don't know for sure. British pound, 1.2120, down almost 4 cents, continued its drop. Their inflation rate has been high, and that may be turning around and hurting their currency. Euros, 1.0192, that's down 1.73 cents. That looks like it's heading for $1 again. Our dollar has just been very, very strong over the last 7 months. And the Japanese 100 yen at 64 cents gained a penny this time around. So overall, this week should be better. I mean, the feeling is that a lot of bad things or questionable things for the economy have been baked into this cake, maybe overbaked. So if not a lot happens, and the inauguration is a week from today, but it may be a quiet week and it may just be a time to gain for some of these things to come back to where they were.
All right. Well, as you mentioned, next week's the inauguration. It's also Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. We will skip a week and we'll check on that cake in 2 weeks with you, James B. Huntington.
Very good. Well, thank you, Tim, and thank you, listeners.
And as she prepares for her State of the State address tomorrow, Governor Kathy Hochul has been promoting what she calls an affordability agenda. Three components of that agenda involve child care. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Capital Region Bureau Chief Dave Lucas reports.
Previewing the address, Hochul revealed plans to push for the establishment of a $110 million child care construction fund to build new child care facilities and repair existing sites. Meredith Cimento is executive director of the Early Care and Learning Council, a state network of 35 child care resource and referral agencies that work directly with child care programs throughout New York State. She says the governor's proposal is commendable.
ECLC applauds the efforts of the governor moving child care assistance from 200% of the federal poverty level to the federal cap of 85% of state median income, meaning that a family of four earning $108,000 can be eligible for child care assistance. We encourage families to use the new online portal, which is making applying for this child care assistance even more accessible for families, or to reach out to a child care resource and referral agency throughout the state for assistance.
Hochul says the plan only helps if there's a place to go.
If you're in a child care desert, doesn't matter. So let's build more. Let's have the ambition to build more facilities and to populate them with more nurturing teachers and teams to support them.
The Democrats' proposal includes launching a New York Coalition for Child Care to bring together business leaders, labor unions, service providers, and tax experts to identify a sustainable path forward for achieving universal child care. Business Council of New York State President and CEO Heather Mulligan says the average cost per child is $15,000 a year.
And there's only 4,200 licensed child care centers in the state. We are very supportive of investing in additional child care facilities and also the governor's support for expanding access to care with a goal towards making it universally available.
KT Korngold is the director of the Montessori Children's Center, a full-time child care center in West Harrison.
There certainly is a need for us to be able to expand child care, not just in the deserts, but in places like where I am located. And if I could open a second center tomorrow, I would fill it tomorrow with children. The challenge we face, though, is not so much about facilities. It's about staffing. And this investment doesn't do anything to help us solve the problem of increased funding for the child care workforce, which is something that the child care workforce has been clamoring for.
Mulligan hails Hochul's proposal to establish a substitute pool to expand the child care workforce, helping providers find trusted, vetted professionals to quickly step in and keep classrooms open.
This is something that's very important because in New York, there are minimum staffing ratios for safety reasons for children. And as a result, child care centers right now, without access to a substitute pool, have to overstaff. And this is one of the things that can drive up the cost of operating a child care center. So we think this is a very thoughtful proposal, and we're very supportive of it.
Hochul is also proposing free breakfasts and lunches for the more than 2.7 million students in schools throughout New York. In Albany, I'm Dave Lucas for the New York Public News Network.
And the State of the State is tomorrow at 1. You can listen to it live here on Radio Catskill or stream it at wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cooked breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
When Adam Galinsky became a dad, he found himself doing something he had vowed never to do.
lose his cool with his kids.
And I trained myself over time to never have that reaction again.
Better ways to deal with stressful situations this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, partial clearing this afternoon, a high of 36. Cloudy overnight and a low of 18. Colder tomorrow with a high of 23. Cloudy skies, winds between 10 and 20 miles an hour. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.